Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we'll explore the ways in which artificial intelligence, otherwise known as AI, may transform healthcare. From self-driving cars to Amazon's Alexa, artificial intelligence is already impacting our day-to-day lives. But nowhere is its potential as great as in healthcare, where AI may prove to be truly life-changing. Artificial intelligence applications are being utilized now for clinical research, drug development, insurance claims, diagnosis, and treatment. Proponents claim that AI will reduce healthcare costs, protect physicians from burnout, and improve patient outcomes. However, serious concerns remain, and critics warn that AI may further dehumanize medicine and increase existing disparities in healthcare. So tonight, we'll ask, will doctors become obsolete in the future, or will artificial intelligence augment patient care? Can this technology be implemented in an ethical way, and how will AI be regulated? Well, we have three guests joining me by phone this evening to discuss these issues. First is Tom Andriola, Vice President and System Chief Information Officer of the University of California System, a public research institution with 10 campuses, 5 health systems, and 3 national laboratories. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
And we're also joined tonight by Glenn Cohen. He's professor of law at Harvard Law School and faculty director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you for having me.
And in a little while, we'll be joined by Dr. Matthew Lundgren, assistant professor in pediatric radiology and associate director of the Stanford Center for Artificial Intelligence in Medicine and Imaging. And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. I'll give you that toll-free number now. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. That number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So I wanted to start with you, Tom Andriola. Before we dive into AI, just let's talk about the current state of healthcare in the United States. Specifically, what are doctors, patients, and healthcare systems facing today?
Yeah, thank you, Joseph. It's a really tumultuous time for healthcare in the United States. I think everyone is at the surface level very familiar with the challenges of rising costs and, you know, the costs going up, more coming out of people's pockets in order for the care that they require. But, you know, at a more, you know, kind of at a system level, now we run 5 different health systems. We are managing about 4.5 million active patients currently across the state of California. And, you know, there's challenges for us on revenues, so reimbursement for providers like ourselves is being squeezed more and more. The cost structure of continuing to keep the best talent in the form of doctors, nurses, researchers coming up with advanced treatments is going up. So we've got a revenue and cost challenges, while the entire, kind of society is looking for understanding the quality of care that they get and what's the cost for that. And so it's a very, very challenging equation to try to manage. And also thinking about that those revenues are impacted by, you know, what kind of patients are coming in and how many of them are predicted and how many of them are just showing up. You know, we tend to think of those with private insurance, the reimbursement rates are higher, but especially being public university, we have a tremendous amount of Medicare and Medicaid patient populations who also come to the University of California facilities in order to get their care. So how do we manage and balance all those different types of patients coming in? On the periphery of the industry, we have all sorts of innovation going on that are driving changes to the system. So, for example, working with the payers today, we have work that are being called value-based care models, which means we're sharing the risk of costs around patients. So if we can create good quality outcomes for our patients at lower costs, we get the share and the financial rewards of that. If we deliver subpar care and patients are readmitted, we actually have to eat those costs. In addition, scientific advancements are moving as fast as they ever have. If you think about the way that the human genome has come down from being $100 million for the first genome that was sequenced now to basically being $1,000, we have now all sorts of new information, and the physical science is helping us actually look at things at a cellular level and a genetic level that can help in the delivery of care. And, of course, maybe the big one is really what technology and consumerization is bringing. healthcare patients, or I like to call them healthcare consumers, are bringing consumer behavior and consumer mentality towards healthcare, wanting to have more choice, wanting to be more directive around what their options are and how they get their care, to want to be interacted with in a more digital form, especially with younger populations. So all of these dynamics are going on in our market right now that make it both very exciting from the standpoint of the amount of change that we'll see in the near and long-term future, but also very challenged to how do we manage through this period of transition.
So that was a great overview of some of the big themes. Let's talk at the personal level. When the UC health systems survey their consumers, as you call them, their patients, what are they liking about the care they're getting? What would they like to see better and change?
Yeah, so I think, so let's talk about the type of facilities we tend to have, right? So we're what we call, academic medical centers. We tend to deal in specialty care, in tertiary and quaternary care. And for many patients, you can talk about cancer patients or complex diseases. We might be the last stop along the line. They've already been to see several different types of doctors before us. We don't deal as much in primary care, right? So we're not seeing a lot of healthy patients. We tend to see the sicker patients, the more complex cases. But when patients come to see us, in many cases, what they're looking for is one, to feel confident about the care pathway that we've put them on, that they're on a path to a better health condition from wherever they're at. That might be as simple as, someone coming in and maybe getting a radiology exam, an MRI in their knee to figure out if they got a torn MCL. It may be a second opinion on a cancer patient, right? So one of the things that in terms of healthcare is people are first and foremost are looking for peace of mind. Second of all, they want to understand more and more how the costs of the care that they're going to get are going to impact their pocketbook, because that's becoming a bigger and bigger issue for the average American in terms of the amount of money that they have to pay into the healthcare system to get the care that they need. The third thing is the healthcare system to the average consumer is very complex to understand and to navigate. And I think one of the big things that we hear is, please make it more simple for me. That could be everything from scheduling to being able to get my information from one doctor to another. I know that, one of my favorite phrases is, our complexity should not be our patient or our customer's problem. We need to make it easy to interact with us, as easy as possible, because they're not coming to deal with our complexity. They're coming to try to improve their healthcare condition. And quite honestly, as more choice becomes available, as with in all consumer-based markets, if people have choices, they will migrate their choices to the places where they have the best experience, trading off things like experience with cost and quality. And I think that's what we're seeing the healthcare environment evolve more to.
So let's take it to the flip side and ask, what are your doctors and nurses and other staff saying about their experience of working in healthcare?
Yeah, and here I would say this is a really interesting one, right? Because we also have a generational change going on in the healthcare provider space. Where older doctors are, have become more frustrated with the amount of documentation and in some cases the amount of technology that we've now introduced that get them, make them feel sometimes that they spend less attention on the patient and more time worrying about the documentation, which from their perception is driven to making sure that we can bill properly. Trying to re-educate them that, this information that we now have about the patient that's all being digitally captured is actually giving us greater insights into patient, but teaching them how to use the tools better. We do see with all this introduction of technology, at least where we're at right now, we spend a lot of time thinking about and analyzing our internal data around physician and nurse burnout from the standpoint of the technology does provide the ability to have greater insights and get off of paper. But if we spend, if I spend a 10-hour shift working in the ICU and then I have to spend another 90 minutes finishing my documentation for the night, that's not a sustainable you know, condition for a professional, to expect a professional to be able to work in, right? So how do we integrate the technology more into the work that people do and reduce the amount of burnout? We see that our younger doctors and nurses are more comfortable with the technologies that are now deployed in our hospitals and clinics. They spend more time with it while they're going through their medical training, and they're just, you know, kind of more comfortable with the devices that they're used to having in their hands and in front of them in their normal lives, that it's more integrated. And, it, you know, again, to walk around a hospital today and look at the medical residents, you know, it's really interesting how, you know, they're not looking for a chart to flip up. They're looking to pull up something very quickly on their phone, or they're looking to the computer that, you know, might be on the other side of the room to go look up, you know, the latest lab values on a particular patient.
So that was Tom Andriola, Vice President and System Chief Information Officer of the University of California System. I want to welcome Dr. Matthew Lundgren, who's just joined us, physician and assistant professor in pediatric radiology and associate director of the Stanford Center for Artificial Intelligence in Medicine and Imaging. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here.
Great. So I'm not sure how much of Tom's opening comments you were able to hear, but basically he was talking. I've asked him about how to just set the landscape of, you know, what are medical consumers or patients looking for. They're looking for confidence and peace of mind, understanding that how costs are going to affect their bottom line, and also wanting to navigate a system more smoothly, to have less complexity. And on the provider side, it seems like technology, which has always been part of medicine, in the way it's being utilized these days can increase physician and nurse burnout and a sense of distance from patients. So as we dive into this concept of artificial intelligence in medicine, how do you place artificial intelligence within the spectrum, the arc of technology within medicine? It's not like medicine hasn't had technology before, but this is a new type of technology. And how do you see it compared to other things that have come into the practice of medicine?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that we've spent a lot of time, you know, in our lab and labs around here and certainly around the country with our colleagues, sort of thinking about, you know, the applications of AI and where they fit in to the broader healthcare environment. And you know, anyone can tell you, and I'm sure that the comments have already come up to sort of point out that, you know, there's a vast heterogeneity with the way that we deploy our healthcare environments, you know, across at least this, you know, this country, where we have, even if you have the same EMR or, you know, the same general, you know, sort of workflows, there can be vastly different you know, ways that we interact with or use technology in each of those settings. And so it does make anything that you create difficult to sort of scale, you know, in a way, at least historically, that we've approached these sort of technical advances. And what I'm talking about, again, is sort of the idea that maybe you can predict, you know, readmissions, or you can predict, you know, 30-day mortality or sepsis, likelihood of sepsis, things like that, where we have seen applications that pre-AI, you know, sort of struggled, I think, to really get a larger audience, owing a lot to a concept called generalization, or basically referring to the heterogeneity across populations. And what we're starting to see with AI is sort of a system or a network of tools that are, you know, on their face, you know, coming up with sort of similar use cases, but they tend to be more robust, I guess is the term they use, but more resilient to sort of shifting populations. Now, they're not perfect, but we think that this may be one of those, you know, sort of advancements, at least on the CS side, as we're sort of having these ongoing conversations.
What's CS?
Medicine.
What's CS?
Computer science, yeah.
Okay,
so the computer science folks, as they sort of come up with advancements in different industries and they're trying to take those applications and the lessons learned to healthcare, we're starting to see that those models could potentially act, you know, fulfill some of the promises that I think some of the earlier technical advances had tried to achieve, and then at the same time, I think potentially democratize the use of these tools well beyond, you know, institutions like Stanford or in the Bay Area, but worldwide, and that's really exciting.
So So tell us now that we've started to throw around some terms, and I'm going to ask you to, any acronyms that you use, please spell those out for us. Tell us a little bit about what artificial intelligence is when it comes to medical care.
Well, I wish I had a simple explanation for that, but I can certainly give some generalities to at least get us all on the same page. I think that when we talk about, you know, artificial intelligence or AI, it really is not a very helpful or specific term, and so, you know, a lot of folks would, you know, use other terminology like deep learning or even machine learning. But the general concept here is that you can take a set of data, whether that be chest X-rays or it be ICU vital signs or notes, and you take that set of data and you put it into a model, and that, again, is sort of the AI part, and you expect that model to predict something, to label something, to again, sort of codify an outcome, for example. And, you know, that's sort of, so the general workflow is you have a large quantity of data, and that data, it, again, can be any number of different things. You know, the challenge is then sort of asking the right question and sort of understanding fundamentally where you'll go with the answer. So just because you can predict something and we find that we can, you know, do that in a variety of settings, what intervention can we, you know, reasonably take, and is that intervention, you know, cost saving or life saving or whatever? And so as we sort of think about, you know, because there's such a broad series of options of data in healthcare, how do we pick those use cases so that, you know, what we come up with is both, you know, helpful but also something that can actually impact care in a positive way? And one of the ways that we've looked at that is to say, well, we aren't looking to find applications that replace, you know, roles in healthcare. We're looking for applications that can augment, and so otherwise, you know, provide additional information that can assist a clinician in his or her role.
So what I hear you saying is that you're taking data.
One second, which is to say,
oh, I'm sorry.
Most people, I think, in this realm view the future not being that there is a computer that will direct your care or a computer that will help in this respect. It's the image from Greek mythology of the centaur, right? Half human, half horse, right? And the idea that we will have AI guiding and helping physicians who are making decisions already based on a set of data and a set of knowledge in their heads that's not quite the same as what they're doing now, but instead being informed by millions of cases from millions of doctors that have been coded and can be done in a more formal way. So the future is not a computer directing your care. The future is a physician making better use of an AI to direct your care.
Okay. So I think this is important, a point you, it sounds like you want to make early on, that it's really not about about replacing healthcare providers. It's just changing the technology that they have in their fingertips. What I wanted to get at was that the data that we're getting, where does that come from? That comes from actual cases, actual people, and we're kind of, it's kind of like we're crowdsourcing the way that this is working. We feed these inputs into the machine, so to speak, and it kind of tries to recognize patterns, so that way when it sees it again, it can just kind of indicate what it thinks is going on. Is that what that this is about partially?
It's a great way to sort of look at it. And I, you know, taking it out of the, you know, healthcare industry, you can look at analogies across, you know, other industries where you're sort of looking at historical data and you're trying to predict, you know, future data. So, you know, if you have all of these stock prices or, you know, all of the prior year's financials and you want to predict where next year's going to go, you know, this could be one way to do that. But you do need data. And just as you're suggesting, healthcare has been using data to make decisions for, you know, decades. But these tools, while they're particularly good in certain cases that, you know, sort of we've been working with, they also are quite a bit more data hungry. In other words, they require a lot more data, and that is not something that healthcare systems generally are, you know, tuned and primed to be able to do. In other words, be able to you know, easily use data in ways that allow, you know, sort of this, you know, this research to happen. And, you know, because they're built to store and house and protect data, right? So it does cause a bit of a shift in sort of, you know, infrastructure, IT support, and certainly strategy for healthcare systems that are looking to, you know, find ways to use these tools in their practices, but also have them sort of maybe even homegrown using patient data that's based on their populations or patients that they're typically seeing.
I'd like to add to that. Right? So if you think about healthcare has been an information-centric industry for a long time, but it never thought of itself that way until we started to really implement electronic medical records in a consistent way across our different hospitals and clinics and physician practices across the country. And then I think healthcare really got it that, you know, it was sitting on this all of this digitally captured information. And quite honestly, if you really think about it, the databases that we have in healthcare are some of the most expensive databases that you could think of on the planet. I mean, think about this. You have medically trained professionals, doctors, nurses, surgeons, cardiologists entering the data around their patients into a database. Think about how expensive that data set is. The fact that we can actually now take and actually leverage it to deliver better care, whether that's more precise, personalized care or extended to across into populations who don't have access to great care because they live in a rural part of America, is something that is, quite honestly, I think an obligation that the healthcare industry takes very, very seriously. And to Matt's point, you know, to be able to kind of find these type of insights using AI technologies like machine learning or deep learning, you need large amounts. So, for example, you know, if we want to find, you know, patterns for breast cancer, right, you know, we at the University of California, we might pull together all of our breast cancer images and to be able to kind of run 200,000 of them and essentially train up a model to be able to recognize a tumor in an image, and again use that as the first step of reviewing images and then bring back those that we think are positive for then the doctor to look at and very quickly rule out all of the negatives. So again, we're now starting to use this data in a way that we can actually benefit the patient in a way that is, I won't say better, but I'll just say right now it's different than we have in the past. That is allowing us to see more patients and actually save the doctor's time for the most complex cases, taking the more simple cases and automating them as much as we possibly can.
So let's talk about some very concrete examples. You mentioned one right there about feeding images into the computer and creating a model that then will allow it to spot the pattern down the road in its various forms. So let's talk about some other things. And what's the current gap in how healthcare is delivered that these ways that AI or artificial intelligence will be applied, that those gaps will be filled or closed? Do you want to take that, Matt Lundgren?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly talk about some, you know, use cases, at least, you know, speaking from the radiology side and even more broadly. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the way healthcare is delivered now, if you have, you know, an accident or you're in a car accident or something, and you go to the hospital and they do, you know, CT scanning of a part of your body, maybe it's your head or your chest or something, and the way that those images are interpreted at the moment come in first come, first serve. You know, so there's lots of patients with various emergencies in the emergency department, and those images are all being sent to a central place in the hospital. A radiologist is reviewing those images in generally the way that they came in and not in order of acuity, because you don't know what's on the image until you look at it. And there's only a certain capacity to have radiologists looking at images at a certain pace. So what AI has started to do, at least in the work that we've been a part of, and this is certainly happening at other centers around the country, is, you know, you have algorithms that can be run in the background and provide near instantaneous sort of quick reads through the images before they even reach the radiologist's list to look at. And it could potentially flag cases that are positive for, you know, emergencies, so things that need to be seen immediately. And, you know, so that's sort of in a broader sense a workless triage, but it's an intelligent way to use these AI tools. Now, we're not taking the place of any current job of a radiologist or anyone else. This is actually just augmenting the capacity to sort of prioritize those patients that need to be seen right away and need treatment right away. And so that's a potential use case that we're already starting to see. We've seen FDA approvals for, you know, various models that can do instantaneous analysis of head CTs for hemorrhage, so for bleeding in the brain, and flag those for radiologists to then, you know, notice that, prioritize that first, and ideally deliver better care. And so, you know, again, there are definitely instances of this kind of a you know, non-intelligent way that we perform some of our tasks in medicine, clearly, that can be augmented, and some of those are things that aren't tasks that we are currently doing. And those are the points I think where we're going to see the biggest and earliest sort of, you know, wins in some using some of this technology, and we're excited to start seeing that in clinical trials.
And Tom Andriola, so far we've been talking about technology that is, as Matt says, is running in the background and is really there to be auxiliary, so to speak, to the professionals, like doctors and nurses and others. How are you seeing this turning into something that's going to be where an interface where the patients, the consumers, will actually be interacting with something that is run by or augmented by AI? What could that look like, or what does that already look like, perhaps?
We're seeing the early stages of that right now. You know, I mean, first of all, I mean, how many of us are walking around with some type of device on our body that's taking some type of reading? So a data generator into the system. I know that I have an Apple phone, and the amount of medical information, now I'm a relatively healthy person, you know, medical information that I'm capturing because I'm interested to look at the patterns is now available at my fingertips. Now let's take the case of, I can give you a couple of quick examples where, you know, where we're seeing technology, you know, home-based technology. I mean, so the future for us is going to be not building more hospitals, but, you know, moving patients who used to be in the hospital and trying to see them in outpatient clinics and trying to take care or interface with our patients more in the home. We're going to see a lot of technologies that where people are going to be interacting with the health system from home. You know, maybe it's a watch, maybe it's their cable desktop, maybe it's their Alexa type device. And again, because we are collecting all this digital information in the background, we could be analyzing it and actually, you know, look at patterns and predict that, you know, this is a patient that we should flag for the nurse practitioner to make a phone call to, because we're seeing signs in terms of slurred speech, or maybe there's a sensor in the home and we see that they're moving a lot more slowly than they used to, or maybe we detected a partial fall, let's make a phone call, right? So that type of predictive ability, because we're in constant analysis of the data that we have on them and that they're generating all the time, we're able to now interact with, you know, with that consumer patient in the home. I think you're going to see a lot more models like that driven not just from the technology companies, but even from the real estate industry, who's starting to look here in California at building communities for older populations to allow them to live independently in their homes at affordable price points. This is something that we're going to see a movement to, not just in the healthcare system, but also in the lifestyle space of our economy.
And I want to round out with one last question to kind of talk about what AI can do for healthcare. Matt Lundgren, what's and Tom Andriola, what's the data out there about how AI, as it's already being applied, is improving healthcare outcomes, or perhaps even lowering costs or improving quality of care?
Yeah, so that's a question that I think we are trying to answer in general. Clearly, this is a newer newer field that has kind of just taken off in the last, you know, I would say 2 to 3 years. And, you know, I think a lot of places are looking at that exact question in various ways. We've chosen to kind of go the route of multi-center clinical trials. So we've kind of taken the culture of, you know, move fast, break things from Silicon Valley, and we've sort of met it with first do no harm from the medical side, and we've tried to sort of put some of these innovations through the standard workflow that we would expect, you know, of any new drug or any new intervention, because we know that we can protect patients while we're observing whether there's, you know, any real effect or not. And that takes time. And so I know that the excitement and the interest and certainly the availability for, you know, these models now and learning about them now is you know, practically ubiquitous. But, you know, the data as we are learning about how they work in practice will take time to come. But, you know, we have the first multi-center trial, at least in terms of the, you know, analyzing pixel data and running that as part of our practice in a trial, and then that, you know, that will be coming out very shortly. But despite having many of these in the pipeline, this is a process that takes time. But we're hoping to answer that question.
Tom Andrill, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think Matt hit it on the head, right? I mean, healthcare by nature is a conservative industry. Doctors want to know that something works before they apply it to a patient. It's worked very well for us. You know, there's a lot of you know, due diligence that's done. But Matt said it very well, trying to marry that with some of the Silicon Valley. How do we move fast to create innovations with impact? You know, some of the things, I think the AI impact right now is helping the payer community more than the provider community. We're seeing a lot of things being rolled out by some of the innovative payer organizations that allow them to ingest a lot of information to help with claims, to identify fraud and those types of things. You know, in the provider community where Matt and I live, I think a lot of it is, you know, doctors are, you know, inherently skeptical, and they want to see how these things work. They want them to go through the tried and true practices of clinical trials. We're trying to embed the things in almost in a kind of a side by side. Okay, let's let the doctor do it the way they normally do it. Let's see what the algorithm would tell us. Let's compare the two, and let's see that the algorithm starts to close the gap between the two when they look like that maybe they're equal. Maybe we'll allow the computer to take the lead on some of the more simple cases, but, you know, not on the more complex cases. So I think we're easing our way into this, and it's really important to understand that these tools will not become highly used until, one, doctors feel like they're safe and they will benefit the patients, number one, and then, two, that they're embedded into the workflow that doctors use every day to see their patients and to practice good medicine. You've got to ultimately, you can have a great, you know, great algorithm that is highly accurate in predicting, but you have to ultimately map it into a place in the clinician's workflow where they can use it in a way that makes sense to them, or they just won't use it.
Speaking of physicians, really quickly, Tom Andrilla, how much of this is a health system like yours or the health systems under the UC system trying to place yourselves to adapt to the fact that there's a predicted shortage of physicians already happening, growing, and that you need to find efficiencies to be able to use the doctors you are able to recruit to be able to do the work that doctors really need to be doing as opposed to what AI could be doing. And I think you mentioned a little bit about that earlier, but specifically when you talk about workforce here.
Yeah, no, I think I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, for the listeners who may be out there, there just was a commission finished up not too long ago, published. It was called the Future Health Workforce Commission in California, really looking at the healthcare needs for the state in the 2030 timeframe. And it was co-chaired by the president of my university, Janet Napolitano, and Lloyd Dean, who's the CEO of Dignity Health. And really was looking at, you know, the University of California was right in the middle of that, because 50%, a little more than 50% of the medically trained professionals each year that graduate come out of one of the UC schools. And so, you know, what we're seeing overall is that the need is growing far beyond what the current workforce can provide. This is what's driving, you know, one, to try to really think about how do we take care of people in the homes, how do we do a better job canvassing the state with, you know, more primary care, so more of the preventive side, and be able to get people access to the system. And again, I see with what technology and AI are bringing also as a way to help with health equity, which is a huge issue for California because we have such a large rural population in our state as well. But if you don't live close to a major medical center, how do you get access to the specialty care that people in the more urban areas get? And again, this is a place where, as we get more AI into our environment, built into our workflows, these tools close to our doctors, people in rural California will be able to get the same quality health care than if you live in San Francisco, L.A., or San Diego.
Okay, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the ways in which artificial intelligence may transform health care. With our guests, that was Tom Andriola, Vice President and System Chief Information Officer of the University of California System. We also were hearing earlier from Matt Lundgren, Assistant Professor in pediatric radiology and associate director of the Stanford Center for Artificial Intelligence in Medicine and Imaging. And in a moment, we'll hear from Glenn Cohen, professor of law at Harvard Law School and faculty director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. So, Glenn Cohen, thanks for being patient there, listening to the conversation unfold. I'm curious, from your vantage point, someone who studies the law and bioethics as it relates to healthcare, when you hear about all this promise that AI or artificial intelligence in healthcare holds, how do you respond? What kind of questions come into your mind?
Great. So I often like to say, as an ethicist and a lawyer, I bring clouds and rain to other people's sunshine, and maybe this is no exception. First thing to say is there's something called the hype cycle, right, for every new technology, and it's these five stages. And unfortunately, I think we're in an early stage of the hype cycle here, which means we're kind of climbing to what's called the peak of inflated expectations, only to be followed by the trough of disillusionment. And believe it or not, it's a good thing that we're moving forward towards disillusionment, because right now we have tons of people throwing things at the wall, trying things out, and most of them should fail. If they don't fail, we're not doing it right. But there's going to be a period where I think we're going to have to really readjust our expectations. Many people will exit the market. So that's just a framing thing, is for your listeners to understand. We're very early on in this, and they should not imagine there's going to be a lot of successful implementations tomorrow. Okay, now putting my had as a lawyer and an ethicist on, I just want to flag some ethical issues that have already come up kind of implicitly in the discussion so far. So first of all, there's a question about where the data is coming from, right? I imagine that the average patient you're talking about has no idea that their data may be used in this way. Many of them would be very happy about it, but we have a lot of questions about whether they ought to have to consent to this or be notified about this or have their attention drawn to it. Also, what role will patients have as a group governing appropriate versus inappropriate uses? There's many studies we could run using patient data that I think would make a lot of patients very uncomfortable. Do we imagine that there'll be groups of patients, unions, or fiduciaries, for example, monitoring that stuff? How representative are the data sets we're talking about? So, my colleagues mentioned EMRs, electronic medical records. Most of the systems we have for recording medical records in this country are really billing systems. They were designed to help billing, and we are kind of scaffolding them from them to medical data. And beyond this, the quality, there's this question about who's included and who's not included. We see a lot of the early models have used data that excludes certain populations, and they may be based on gender, they may be based on race, class, geography. And when you look at how they perform with other kinds of groups, you often get results that are quite different. So how do we ensure that there's good representativeness of the data? Okay, well, let's imagine you solved all of those problems, and they are important. Well, now you're building your model. How the heck do we know it works? What are the standards for auditing it? Is it just going to be controlled by the companies developing it, and will the underlying algorithms be protected, or the underlying data, as a trade secret, such that it's very hard to get in there and verify? How can we promote more transparency about what's going on in the model so providers, patients, tinkerers, everybody can understand it better? Well, now you've developed a model. Great. You want to use it. Do individual patients have to be notified if a model will make a huge difference in their care? Does there have to be an explicit conversation about this fact? Or is it the case that we'll just have it be used the way doctors use a whole bunch of other kinds of resources? When something goes wrong, who has the liability? Who pays for it? Who's going to regulate this? We heard earlier about the clash between Silicon Valley culture on the one hand, which is fail fast and fail often, and the randomized clinical trial model. Should we make all of these things undergo a randomized clinical trial, which will be much more expensive, take a longer time, but produce probably better results? And what do we do when you suddenly want to upgrade the model, right? We want these models to keep learning based on new data. And what happens when you have a bunch of new data you've implemented? Does a regulator like the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, have to look at it again? And finally, and these are just the big points here, you know, William Gibson once said, the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed. And there's this question about equity about these models. These AIs are being built on the backs of all the patients' data across America and in some cases across the world. But they're often being developed in a commercial setting where they will be sold or licensed and the like. What obligations do we have to ensure that there is equitable access, that everybody whose data was contributed to the model can benefit from it? So this is what I think is the agenda for people who are concerned about the direction of this technology.
Thank you so much for that really concise and yet very deep set of questions there that I'm going to now, of course, ask Tom Andriola and Matt Lundgren to respond to. And, of course, Glenn, I invite you to kind of to add to the questioning here as you wish. So let's start first with this question of the data. First of all, who it belongs to, right? It belongs to, in some ways, the patients that from whom it was taken. But then again, it was processed by the medical providers, and then it got into a computer system. And so questions about where the data come from, how do people have to consent, should people have to consent to their data being used to create a potentially commercially used product that will, yes, help people's potentially their physical health over time, but what role do people have or what claim do they have to that data being used or how it is used? So let's start with that first question. Tom Andriola.
Yeah, sure. So I really appreciate Glenn's description, because I think it's exactly the challenges and that we are trying to figure out also how to navigate. Again, the technology and the possibilities are moving very, very fast. How do we balance that with the risks and also doing the right thing? In 2017, we went through a very thoughtful process of trying to a broad conversation across our entire university, trying to wrap our head around the challenges here and what were a set of principles by which we could think about this problem, where on one side we feel like the university has a unique responsibility around its mission to try to do everything it can to help its patients. At the same time, there are these very, very thorny issues from a regulatory and ethical perspective that we have to figure out how to balance the potential. And so, we started to, address a couple of the things that Glenn mentioned. You know, one is the notion of transparency, and that we need to be transparent. Just because a patient signed a waiver when they came in, terms and conditions sheet that says that, we could use their data for anything we wanted to use, that's not the same as engagement and endearing trust. We feel like there needed to be extra steps, and there will always need to be extra steps with respect to helping the patient understand and consent that, we'll be using their data for developing these type of algorithms and capabilities for the future. We talked a lot about justice in this, in that, we need to be designing these things, and then when we, for example, may do a partnership where we're sharing our data with a third party where we're co-developing these type of algorithms, that we do it with the basis of trying to help all patients, not just patients with private insurance who can afford to pay. and that is, you know, very, very kind of core to the mission of the University of California, and that, you know, when we do these things, we want to make sure that there is a public benefit that we can align to, that it makes sense for us to work with these different third parties and share patients' data for the purposes of bettering healthcare, always tying back to that we need to maintain this very, very strong trust with our patients, that we, you know, that the steps that we take will always come back to being in their best interest. So I wouldn't say that we've got it right. I mean, I say that it's an ongoing dialogue of us trying to challenge where we have the opportunities to do these things, but trying to do it in a way that's very consistent with the principles that we decided were important for us as we try to navigate into this future.
So, Glenn, quickly, what do you think of those two guiding principles of, you know, transparency, sort of uber consent from the patient, and not just sign here so we can move on, and this principle of justice, how this technology is going to be applied and who can access it?
So these principles are definitely in the right direction, but there are some hard trade-offs here, and the devil's in the details, right? So, you know, on the one hand, you have the idea that a patient will just find this as boilerplate the first time they join a practice or come to the hospital and never have it drawn to their attention. But that's on one extreme, and I'm glad, you know, to hear it sounds like that's not what we're doing in this case. But on the other extreme, you know, we're not, I find it unlikely that we're going to ask patients, constantly remind them, oh, by the way, you know, we're going to be using your electronic medical record with some de-identification in this way. You know, chances are, and what if about patients who say no? And this is also an interesting problem, a trade-off here, in that you want the data sets to be as complete and representative of the population as possible. And the more opportunities you have for people to opt out and to leave the data set, the more data you're losing and the more gaps you're creating. And you don't know whether your data set is representative of your entire patient population. So I'm curious about the details. As I warned you, I'm a lawyer, and I always want to know about the details about how these principles of consent are being carried out in the actual clinical encounter.
So next, Matt Lundgren, I'm going to ask you to answer the question as best you can about the representativeness of the data, both about, you know, how do you make sure it's quality data going in so that you get a model that looks, that ends up doing what it's supposed to be doing, but also a model, data sets that are representative of the population in all of its diversity, which, depending on where those data sets came from, could have significant gaps in them.
Yeah, this is something that we, of course, have talked about quite a bit, and this is a you know, conversation that's gone on for, again, you know, the decades that, you know, machine learning has been in healthcare. Whenever you have a model that you've developed, and let's take AI out of the equation and go back and to the logistic regression, something simple that's used all the time to sort of try to predict something, you take an anonymized data set of prior patients that may have the same condition, and you try to predict how a given treatment might work. Those kinds of discussions around, does your data really represent, you know, the patients that you're hoping to impact, and would it also work for a patient population that is, you know, in Kansas City or in, you know, Dubai or wherever else? And if not, what do you have? What are the, you know, sort of, what's the science behind making that work, you know, more generalizable? I think from our standpoint, I mean, we spend a great deal of time looking at, and this is a fundamental piece of the AI, you know, work that we're doing, is to look at biases. I mean, biases are inherently a critical piece of developing these models and then deciding whether what they're predicting or what they're trying to predict is based on a bias that is unfair to, you know, to certain populations, or is it just simply leading us in the wrong direction? And so, you know, I think when it comes back to the concept of, you know, is your data complete? Is it representative? That's a fundamental piece of any data science, you know, project, is to try to get to a place where that is a checkbox that you try to check before you move on. And that's true about anything in medicine. I mean, in terms of clinical trials that we perform, how do we know that whether clinical trials are really representative of, you know, the populations that these you know, outcomes and medications are applied to? We actually don't, right? And so we've seen indications where, you know, I think there's been a lot of discussion around, you know, the cardiac care guidelines, whether those were developed on you know, clinical trials that were not representative of large portions of the population, in particular women, and whether that's a fair way to be, you know, continuing to practice as opposed to using, you know, for example, a data set that came from, you know, our hospital with an equal proportion of men and women and the other sort of considerations in the data set and then applying it to a new patient. Is that a better way? I don't think anyone has a clear answer to that, but I think that we're starting to get to the important questions and all of which have been raised here. And as these AI tools are starting to accelerate the pace at which we are developing models and testing things out, those questions are coming up more and more often. And so I think that, you know, we've spent a lot of time partnering with other large healthcare systems to convene ethics conferences to sort of decide as a larger group what we believe, you know, makes sense, and getting input from, you know, ethicists and obviously legal departments and certainly patients in that process has been extremely enlightening. And some of the things that have been said here tonight have certainly come up multiple times.
So back to you, Glenn Cohen. So what's the follow-up question to that in terms of how do you make sure that if we're going to try to do it better, because perhaps, Matt, you were saying there that there's bias in the way medical knowledge is accumulated currently. If we're going to do it better now, Glenn Cohen, what kinds of things do we need to do or ask or safeguards we need to be put in place that so that it is more representative and it does look at the variety, the diversity of who are patients, which is basically everybody?
So 2 points. First of all, I think my colleagues on the phone have it exactly right. The right question to ask is not, is this the panacea, is this the best thing since sliced bread, but the as against what question, right? Is it likely that moving to these models, as they suggested, lots of current medical practice is outdated, it's biased, it's incorrect. And not, the question isn't whether you can reach perfection, but whether you can do better than you are doing now in terms of using these kinds of models. As one of my colleagues said, they are adopting what I think is the most rigorous way to test AIs, which is to basically do it in clinical trials. There's different ways of structuring that. I will say that I think my impression, I'm curious what the other two on the phone think, is that many people who are working on AI models these days are not necessarily using the clinical trial framework. Clinical trials are good because we're randomizing or we're cluster randomizing, and we're basically very assured that the results are the result of the difference of using the AI or not. I think we need to come to some common decisions about what the standards of validation ought to look like across the industry. And I think we also have to think a little bit about how much regulation we want here. Do we think about this like a drug, where there's a lot of regulation, a lot of pre-approval, a lot of steps, but makes it quite expensive to develop? Or do we think of this more like software, which in the medical context is often not regulated by FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, unless it happens to be baked into a device. And even there, the Food and Drug Administration doesn't really care that much, in the past at least, for regulating software. So I think there is this really deep trade-off, and I don't want to make it sound like there are easy, obvious answers here, but I think we have to really face the trade-offs head-on about the most rigorous forms of validation, which will slow things down, make them more expensive, and make some things not enter the market. Or are we willing to take a little bit more risk, have a little less certainty about efficacy, for example? And I'm curious what my colleagues think.
Tom Andriola? Tom, are you there?
I'm sorry, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead. Would you like to answer that question from Glenn?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question real quick? Glenn was a little hard to hear.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just to say two things. We'll just maybe focus on one of them, which is to say I'm curious whether you think all AI that's being used in the medical context really ought to be subject to randomized clinical trials, and if not, where you think the trade-offs are between certainty here versus cost, delay, and the like, and how you think about what level of regulation would be optimal.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think both sides of this. I mean, I've worked in healthcare long enough that, been a part in different roles earlier in my career around clinical trials and understand the rigor behind that. But then, being also from the technology field, the technology field uses this concept very frequently called the A-B test, and I've kind of been toying around with how valuable. So obviously we could use the traditional clinical trials approach, which we are and will continue to use, but could we also have a similar type of validation through the concept of the A-B test, where we do things in a side-by-side manner, where we can basically train the computer by emulating and making the same decisions the doctors would be, and over some period of time validate that the machine is now ready to handle certain cases because it's proven over time that it has done an equivalent job. And who gets to make that determination, and how would you come to that decision? For me, there's still a lot to be learned here. I think we're still very early in figuring out when it will make, when is the right time to start to allow the algorithms and the AI technologies to take on a greater responsibility for healthcare decisions.
I just want to get a couple of emails in here. Email from Rod, who says, "What if I don't want to have Alexa listening to me in my home? Will patients have the option to opt out of these advances in technology?" I think that's an unanswered question. I'm just putting it out there. And then to bring this back to a point you made earlier, Glenn, an email from Maureen. "What happens if something goes wrong? Who's at fault? How will these machines learn from their mistakes?" So how is the liability question going to be answered, or what's the process to answer that question from your point of view, Glenn?
So first of all, first thing to know is quite uncertain at the present moment. We actually have very few cases on the subject. But the cases we do have, which are mostly over more old-school computerized decision aids, tend to actually hold physicians liable when they follow decision aids that have errors baked into them. So even though they followed, they did what they were supposed to do, they relied upon it, nonetheless, unfortunately, the physicians end up not only being sued, but actually being held to have committed malpractice in some instances. Now, that made sense in a world where we were talking about the physician really having the command of all the information and really being front and center in the decision-making. In a future world where more of this, more of what's feeding into the physician's decision is coming from algorithms that are not only not well understood, but may not be reducible to human language, more black box, I think there's some pressure on whether this is the right way to do things and whether instead we should move to something more like workers' compensation or the vaccine compensation fund, where we just give people compensation when they're injured and we have everybody who makes these models pay into it rather than having this fault-based liability for physicians. I think that's an interesting possibility.
So we have about a minute and a half left to the program. I'm sure we could go on for longer. But in turn, Tom, Matt, and then Glenn, last comments or thoughts about what we should be looking out for, what questions we should be asking? Tom, you first.
Oh, man, I'm always going first. I'll quote Roy Amar first, the American researcher who gets credit for saying, coming up with the phrase, we tend to overestimate the impact of technologies in the short term and underestimate in the long term. I think that perfectly applies to the journey we're on here for healthcare. The question that I think about is, how do we create a future where these technologies augment what doctors do in a way that improves the quality of care and provides a higher quality of care for, in our case, all Californians, all Americans, all humans.
All right. And quickly, Matt Lundgren.
I think from our perspective, one of the things that we've, kept as a singular goal of a lot of the work that we've done as we've done it is to, imagine that, any advancements that we're making here for, the patients that we serve, in our immediate area, try to think bigger, try to expand the scope of the potential impact and think, larger. And by doing that, I think we'll achieve some of the goals that we have of democratizing these tools for use by anyone, anywhere in the world.
All right. And Glenn Cohen, you get the last word.
Everybody's focused on pushing the frontiers of doing what we do better, and that's a good thing to be focused on. But the real easy money here, the money left on the table, is, as the last my colleague said, democratizing expertise. Let's get everybody to have excellent quality of care available to the people who have the most resources today. That's where AI has the most justice-enabling opportunities.
And I want to thank my guests, Tom Andriola, Vice President and System Chief Information Officer of the University of California System, Glenn Cohen, Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and Faculty Director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics, and Matthew Lundgren, Assistant Professor in Pediatric Radiology and Associate Director of the Stanford Center for Artificial Intelligence in Medicine and Imaging. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer of this evening was David LaTulipe. Thanks for letting me go over. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join my co-host Ethan Elkind for an update on how California is doing with its experiment in legalized cannabis. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.